Phil mentioned YouTube. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention that our next speaker also has videos on YouTube. If you search for Parenting Beyond Belief on YouTube, you'll find a series of videos by Dale McCowan. In 2008, Dale McCowan was named Harvard Humanist of the Year by the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University. He's the executive director of the charitable organization Foundation Beyond Belief, which seeks to demonstrate humanism at its best by supporting efforts to improve this world and this life, and to challenge humanists to embody the highest principles of humanism, including mutual care and responsibility. He's the editor of two books, Parenting Beyond Belief, editor and co-author, I should say, Parenting Beyond Belief and Raising Free Thinkers, the first comprehensive resources for non-religious parents. He writes a secular parenting blog, The Meming of Life, and presents seminars for non-theistic parents across the United States in 27 cities so far. In 2009, he gave me his kind permission to broadcast a low-power radio station we have here in Madison, a platform address he gave to the St. Louis Ethical Society in January 2009 on Parenting Beyond Belief, Raising Ethical Kids Without Religion, probably the best podcast I've obtained from that source. And he was my favorite speaker at the Unitarian Universalist Association General Assembly in Minneapolis in 2010, and he was a keynote speaker for the UU's Liberal Religious Education Association. Let's welcome Dale McCowan.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Bob. Mics are good? Okay. First of all, I want to say you're welcome, because 2 days ago I threw out the talk that I had prepared for today. There's all this recent research on parenting styles that I've been reading up on, and I just wanted to cram it all in there, and it was horrible. It was absolutely terrible. I think it's better than, instead of doing 12 different topics poorly, it's really better to just do one topic poorly. So what I'm going to do is focus on one idea that I think is one of the most important ideas in non-religious parenting, and I want to illustrate it through stories of my own parenting, my own family. These are my kids, Delaney, Connor, Aaron, 10, 16, and 14. But they were not always that age. Connor was once 4 years old. He does not know I use this picture. Let's just keep it in this room, okay? Yeah. So anyway, Connor was 4 years old. He was going to a Lutheran preschool. We were living in the Twin Cities. This was not Missouri Synod. This was actually the Lutheran Light. It was actually a really good program, the strongest program in our area. But I wondered for a while if it was going to be an issue. And for a long time, it wasn't. It was really, he was getting a good socializing, good academics, good basic brimstone-free, Jesus loves you kind of religious literacy. And then one day, he was walking up the stairs of our home, and I was following him up the stairs, and I said, "Hey, Connor, you're so tall. Why are you growing so big?" And he said, "I don't know, Dad. I guess God just wants me to grow." Which was cute. I nearly fell off the stairs, and it actually wasn't the religious content exactly. It wasn't just that he had referred to God. It was the first incurious reply I had ever heard from him. It was the first time I'd ever heard him answer a question with basically, "I don't know and I don't really need to know because somebody else has that taken care of for me." That was a problem for me. And I knew where it had come from. That had come from his school. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't really know the best response to that. I recognized immediately that, first of all, this is about more than religion. This was about religion, but also a whole lot of other stuff. And I recognized that there were better and worse ways to respond to this kind of a statement from a child, and I just hadn't really sorted it out yet. So I said, nothing. You know, a lot of people would say, well, there's an obvious answer. Just say, oh, you know, funny thing, there is no God. You know, God is pretend, but your dad is not pretend, and here I am standing on the stairs, 6'1", maybe that's why you're tall. But I had an intuition that there was a better approach to this. I just didn't know what it was yet. So I began working on it. I began doing a lot of reading, a lot of talking, looking into developmental psychology, looking into intellectual development, all sorts of things over the years, so that when his youngest sister, Delaney, was four, and asking a lot of the same kind of questions and making some of the some similar, getting into some similar topics, I had a plan. I knew what I was doing a lot more than I did with Connor. We'll get to Aaron in just a little bit, by the way, different stories. But Lainey was going to the same Lutheran preschool, and she came to me once at the age of four, and she said that she had finally figured out the God and Jesus thing, as she put it, because they had talked about these guys in her school, but they never explained the division of labor, you know, between sort of the God and the demigod. And so she created her own theology. She said, I think Jesus made all the nice things in the world, and God made all the bad and scary things. So like puppies and PBS are from Jesus, and, you know, tornadoes and Fox News are from God. And I knew what to say. I knew what I wanted to say. What I said was, I never thought of it like that, which is true. And I said, that is really cool that you're thinking about these things. You know what I want you to do? The next idea you get, I want you to be sure to tell me. Okay, now what that introduced was the idea, first of all, that it's really cool to be asking these questions, because it is, at age four. And also, keep thinking, right? It's a process that keeps going. Tell me your next idea when you get it. And so about a week later, she came to me and said, I actually think that God makes all the things for grown-ups and Jesus makes all the things for kids. I thought this was just fascinating. She's sort of, it's like a Manichaean dualist dividing the world into, you know, good and evil and all this. My favorite example is, she said, God made the deep end of the pool and Jesus made the shallow end for me. And I gave her a hug and I said, so God for me and Jesus for you, is that the way it is? And she said, I guess so. I'm not sure. I'm still thinking about it. Which is just perfect. So about a month after that, I'm driving her home from the school, and she said that she had a conversation that day with her teacher, Mrs. W. And she said, I told Mrs. W. that I don't really believe in God, but I'm still thinking about it. And I asked her if she believes in God. And I said, oh, what did she say? And she said, well, she said, oh, I very much believe in God. I said, what did you say? And she said, well, that's okay. She said, that's okay, as long as you're still thinking about it, too. Yeah. That to me was out of the park. I mean, that was really the best thing I could possibly have hoped for. So this has been the approach that we've taken from the beginning with our kids, which is that, what great questions, what great ideas, keep thinking, keep sharing it with me, right? You can make up your own mind and you can change your mind as often as you want. Those are really powerful things that most kids don't get, those invitations, right? So when she came to me and said, did Jesus really come alive after he died? I always gave my opinion. This is one thing I hear occasionally from atheist parents. They actually don't tell their kids what they believe because they're so concerned about indoctrinating them. They're so concerned about that, which is a really good concern. I didn't want to do that either. But here's what you do. I said, I don't think he did. I don't think he came alive. I think that's a story that was made up so that we would feel better about death. But you really ought to talk to Grandma Barbara, because I know that she thinks he did. And then you get to make up your own mind, and you can change your mind 1,000 times if you want. That has ended up being the golden road. It's the most honest, straightforward way, and what it shows is that I've got confidence in the process of reason. If I actually give kids what I had when I was a kid. Now, my parents did it accidentally. You know, we went to church every Sunday and all that sort of thing, but I think they were simply too tired to indoctrinate me. You know, they did... They were very, very busy, and as a result, but what they did do is give me this, sense that education is vitally important, and they gave me this ravenous curiosity about the world. That's the combination. Education is a value, ravenous curiosity, and then give them space to think. Don't push. And I am confident in where that leads. If reason doesn't lead to my worldview, right, then I think that's a problem with my worldview. But I'm actually fairly confident that it does. But the only way to really be honest about that is to let it go. Now, not everybody feels this way. This is a Anybody know Joyce Meyer? She's a televangelist in St. Louis. Weirdly lived about 3 miles from my mother for years. She has a series of books called, it's actually just a couple of books, Battlefield of the Mind, and then there's Battlefield of the Mind for Teens. Has sold over 1 million copies, according to her website. So this is not a fringe voice. This is somebody who is influencing a lot of this dialogue. Here's what Joyce Meyer thinks about letting kids think independently. Here's the advice she has for parents. Satan will look for your child's weakest area and attack at that point. He will attempt to fill your child with worry, reasoning, fear, depression, and discouraging negative thoughts. That's the book. You can go check it out. I actually thought when I first saw that, I'm missing the context or something. She just put reasoning in Satan's toolkit. But it goes on. She says, I once asked the Lord why so many people are confused, and he said to me, is that first of all? Tell them to stop trying to figure everything out, and they will stop being confused. I have found it to be absolutely true. Reasoning and confusion go together. That's true, right? If you don't think about it, it's not confusing. So I'm with her on that one. Now here's the statement that she gives to teenagers. This is from Battlefield of the Mind for Teens. Now this one makes me ill. This is what she's saying to teenagers at precisely the moment they're supposed to be entertaining a wide variety of ideas, she says. Ask yourself continually, what would Jesus think? If he wouldn't think about something, you shouldn't either. By keeping continual watch over your thoughts, you can ensure that no damaging enemy thoughts creep into your mind. That is nauseating. That is insane, right? It tells kids that even letting the thought in the first place is a problem. And the interesting thing is you'll actually get, kids can sometimes absorb this even if they haven't had religious training. My daughter at one point was, Erin, the middle one, about age 9, she was crying at bedtime, crying at night, and wouldn't tell me why, which is not good. And I finally, come on, sweetie, I want to know what it is so I can help. It's going to be fine. You know, you don't have to worry about it. Well, it turned out that she said, I heard this bad word at school. And she said, now it's in my mind, and I can't stop thinking about the word, and it makes me feel like a bad person. And this is really Erin. She's really concerned about values and concerned about, you know, kind of the good and evil side of things. Doesn't always go the right way with that one. When she was 4, she saw Snow White, and there's the scene where the trees are sort of reaching down. They start to become these sort of anthropomorphized hands. Remember that scene? And Snow White's running in the storm. And she said, what are those? And I said, oh, that looks like some sort of evil hands, B. That's her nickname. And she said, I want to be those evil hands. Everything's fine. She's turned out fine. But anyway, she had this word that kept popping in her mind. And I said, the word was asshole, by the way. Everybody is wondering. I had to tell her, it is okay to think anything. You have permission to think anything. If you don't let it in, how can you decide whether it's a good thing or not, right? You have to let it in. You have to think about it. And then, now if you act on an idea, then you can be held responsible for your action. But it's never a bad thing. And you actually have to tell kids this, because they will somehow, get this, you know, from going to church. They will get this kind of message. So she's talking about, she's reinforcing something that kids are already slightly inclined to. You've got to let them know that there are no unthinkable thoughts and no unaskable questions. Okay, so a related topic, one that comes up a lot, is the whole Santa question. And what to do. You know, a lot of parents say, what should you do? Some people say, I don't want to lie to my kids ever about anything. And I think that's fine. I think it's perfectly fine to not do the Santa thing. I also think it's kind of a missed opportunity. It's something that if you do it with a light touch, if you do it in a particular way, it can be an unmissable opportunity for critical thinking. It can just be something that is fun and light and valuable. in the long run. Now, my wife and I sort of stumbled backwards into this because we did Santa when we were kids and all that. So we started doing it with our kids without really thinking about it. And then I began to realize that something much more powerful was going on with my kids, because our culture has set up a silly temporary myth next to its silly permanent one, right? And there's this magic man who rewards good behavior and punishes you when you're bad and so on. But everyone is expected to outgrow this, right? If you're 35 years old, the father, you know, with all his kids around, he's still looking up the chimney and wondering, that's a problem. So the way we handled this with our kids is they would begin asking skeptical questions, typically, you know, age 5 or age 6, something like that. They start with the questions, but they never ask the question. They tend not to ask the question right away. First, they ask all these ancillary side questions. They say, how do reindeer fly? Right? And I said to Connor, well, some people say, and this is the way I would always set it up, it's not, I'm not saying that this is what I think, but some people say they eat magic corn. And this skeptical, science-minded kid would go, okay, and he'd go play. He actually was not interested in stopping his belief. He was not interested in leaving his belief behind. There was just this sort of nagging thing that came up, and he kind of, oh, good, okay, I can set that aside, because magic corn, you know? And then, yeah, how does it get around the world in one night, you know? And I remember one time I said, well, some people say it's not a literal night, you know? But all these side questions, and never ask the question. And I had told myself, when they ask the question, you answer it, right? You give them the honest answer. And finally, one day, age 9, we're in the Target parking lot, snow come down, bell ringer, the whole thing. And he said, is Santa real? Looked me right in the eye and said, is Santa real? And I said, well, what do you think? And he said, I think it's the moms and dads. And I said, you got it. You figured it out. You looked at all the clues and figured it out. That's great. And he said, oh, good. I said, oh, why is that good? And he said, well, the world makes sense again. Because everything he's learning about physics and gravity and all these sorts of things. And there's this magic man at the North Pole with the flying reindeer and all that sort of thing. So, and he was fine. And then he's one of them behind the curtain, and, you know, he would sort of, you know, continue this. It has ended up being the sort of thing that I think has given my kids the opportunity to be inside a cultural myth system and find their own way out, find their own way out under their own power. And there has actually been a study, amazingly, done on how kids react to finding out that there's no Santa. University of Ottawa, I think it was, did this. 6% of kids end up feeling some form of betrayal. A lot more feel sort of disappointment or something like that. Some of them just feel excitement at having figured it out. I'm convinced that the ones who feel betrayal are the ones who had parents extend it beyond its natural course. If they figured it out and you put them back in the bottle, that's a very bad idea. There's all sorts of disrespect that's being done to their autonomy when you do that. But playing it with a light touch is something that I think is fun, it's enjoyable, and ends up actually giving them a really valuable lesson. So that's my take on that particular one. The last story, this is Erin when she was 10. Also related to this idea, you can see that all these stories are about trying to respect my child's autonomy, ultimately. Trying not to take my settled answers and putting it on them. The reason for this, by the way, has to be said, it's not that I don't have confidence in my worldview, it's actually quite the opposite. I am standing on a foundation. Having placed every brick myself, I created my own worldview. I came to my decisions based on my own discoveries. And that is an incredibly satisfying thing. My guess is that you know exactly what I'm talking about. People in this room would know what I'm talking about. Knowing that there was no part of my foundation that somebody handed to me as a finished package is a really satisfying thing. It also makes my worldview incredibly strong. I can defend any aspect of my worldview. And the adventure has been, frankly, thrilling to do that. Do I really now want to take the thrilling adventure that I had, bundle it up as a package, and make that part of my children's foundation? And say, you know what, you don't have to worry about that. Turns out there's no God. Stand on this. It's not going to have the same meaning to them. It's not going to have the same feeling of having figured out this really deep cultural myth on your own. So I want them to have that same satisfaction. Okay, so the final story here, Aaron, age 10. Now, some of this I'm going to forget. The wording is important, but she came to me and said that she wanted to wear something to school. And it made her feel a little weird to wear it. So she didn't know if she should. See, here's Aaron with the should questions again. And she wanted to know how I'd feel. So I said, well, what is it you're thinking about wearing? And she slowly reveals this cross pendant on a chain. And I remembered when she bought it. She bought it at a dollar store in Florida. All these crosses, all these beaded crosses that they had, all for a dollar. I always pictured that there should have been a sign that said, Jesus saves, why not you? So I said, well, why does it make you feel weird to think about wearing that? And I thought she was going to say something about me. You know, something about, well, I know that you don't, you know, believe in something like that. You might think it was strange. And she said, well, it's because I don't really believe in God, and I don't want people to think I do. I think I might feel dishonest if I wear it. That was a really good reason, I thought. But I said, you can totally decide on your own, but if you don't wear it, how are you going to know how you feel? You know, you should have the experience of doing that, and then you can decide. Now, if I had simply said, I really don't think you should, if I decided in advance, she wouldn't have learned how it felt. And she said, well, there's something else. There's another reason I like to wear it. And I said, what is that? And she said, well, it feels good when I rub it. And I had been ready for that sentence for years. But the context was all wrong. So she said, you know, when I'm worried, I just kind of rub the cross and I feel better. And she had also said before that, it makes me feel good to wear it. And I thought she meant like makes me feel like a good person or something, but she just meant, you know, it's like a little talisman. I had a jade worry stone when I was in middle school. It, you know, it's a cool thing. I said, give it a go. Give it a try. And she wore it for a week, and at the end of the week, she said, you know what, I'm not going to wear it anymore. It really makes me feel kind of weird. And there it was, a decision that she had, and again, she'd placed a brick. She had actually had the experience. I think one of the worst things we can do is intercept our kids too early, get them away from those experiences, and deprive them of the opportunity to build that foundation themselves. Okay, I want to leave some time for questions, so let's go ahead and just cut it there.
If anyone has any questions, you can come right up over here, speak in the microphone.
You said that you you try not to answer your children's questions with certainty. But do you believe that you should answer questions of science fact with certainty? So they ask, does Santa exist, and you equivocate so that they make the decision. But
right.
If they said, does gravity exist, would you equivocate, or would there be a point at which you insisted that, no, I can demonstrate that this is true?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't put science in the same category. I don't treat science as if it's a form of religion. I don't think you should do that at all. But what I also don't do is speak of things in terms of certainty, because scientists don't either. What I say is, the evidence is there. The evidence is extremely compelling. I am entirely convinced, and you should look at the evidence and see if it's convincing. So it just sets it up in a way that they don't have to accept it. They know that there is an evidentiary foundation for that. But I don't put it in the same category as religion. Well, you know what I should say? I put religion in the same category as science. That's actually the way I go with it, because religion consists of a whole lot of existence claims, you know, claims that something exists or something happened and so on. And so it should also be required to show evidence. It shouldn't be placed in a separate category.
Another non-question from me. Yesterday I mentioned something called Smart Recovery. It's a group that, and I think you know about it, and what I wanted to say is thank you, because Beyond Belief has made a wonderful donation and supports Smart Recovery, which I guess you know, but a lot of folks here don't know, is a secular approach to recovery from addictions. Yeah. And, well, what you do with kids, you're also helping to do for people with addictions, which is so much controlled by the hegemony of the spiritual fellowships.
Terrific, thank you. Yeah, Smart Recovery was one of the first beneficiaries of Foundation Beyond Belief. Really a terrific group. Yeah.
I actually was an AODA therapist, and I quit because I couldn't stand it, so thanks. my question is actually for you as a parent.
Yeah.
My struggle is actually with other parents who are telling me what to do with my child. My husband and I both have raised him to be a free thinker, but it's the other parents that have been really hard to manage. We've been pretty much ostracized in our community because of it, and now we're finding even more that we went to a Waldorf school because we thought that would be more rethinking, and we're finding more and more that it's not. And one of the comments I just had recently from a parent was, we talked about Santa Claus and reasoning, and one of the questions was, as a 9-year-old, what have you seen as the change during this developmental stage? And I said, well, he's really figured out himself that Santa Claus doesn't exist. And one of the parents was like, oh my God, well, wonder still lives in our house. And I said, wonder still lives in our house too, and it will for a very long time. We just let him figure it out. But it's been really, really hard now that he's awakened. And he even made himself an atheist for it, but he had to share it because everybody's supposed to share, but, you know.
Yeah, and where do you live?
We live in Lake Mills, which is like 25 miles west of east. I don't know where I am. East.
Okay.
And what a difference. I mean, it's a very conservative county.
Yeah.
I work in Waukesha County, which is ultra-conservative. Yay! I'm the only atheist on staff at my community mental health clinic. So, it's been interesting.
Yeah. This is really one of the challenges. And the reason I ask where you're from is that really does matter. It really makes an enormous difference whether you're raising kids in Manhattan or a place like Atlanta, which is a relatively blue area in a very conservative state, or, you know, just a plain old flat-out red area. One of the things to do is to really recognize, it's a difficult path, but to recognize that you are almost certainly not the only atheist in X, you know, whatever it is. People are frequently convinced that they're the only ones in their neighborhood or in their school or, you know, in the stands at the soccer game or whatever it is. Just realize that they're making the same assumption about you if you're not out, right? Most people assume that everybody else is in the majority. It is amazing. It is amazing how being out and normal, right? I mean, it just blows people's minds. I've had so many people sort of have that reaction of, and you're such a kind-hearted person, you know? It's kind of, you know, that reaction can actually be a positive thing. Some people are you're never going to get anywhere with, but you need to find those people who are either think the same as you or are religious and open. And getting there is a problem, but you basically have to smile your way there. Because the more you sort of wall yourself off, the less that's going to happen. It's very difficult. I really feel for you, especially being in an area that, you know, where you feel so isolated. Oh, see, isn't that amazing? Yeah, and kids are different. Kids are so different in their ability to do that, but some are just so amazingly good at that. Great. All right, sure.
I think it's possible to be out. We're out within the homeschooling community, so it's possible to be out as atheist and incredibly freeing. I wanted your thoughts about building a place for children in the atheist community. There's Camp Quest, which is 1 or 2 weeks during the summertime.
Right.
Some atheists go to the UUAs. We're not comfortable with the UUA for the amount of woo, but your ideas.
Yeah, this is one of the most exciting things that's going on in the movement right now. which is we're filling in the hole. There's been a donut in the movement. Young people and, you know, students, people recently graduated from college and so on, and then older folks, you know, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and family age, people have been missing from a lot of the local groups and the national groups and so on because, like Phil said, a lot of people have kids and they bounce right back into church for the benefits, the actual benefits you get from being part of that community. Most of the people are actually there for those benefits. They're not there for the theology. They sort of yeah with the theology, but then they get all this family support. They get all this sort of, you know, community support in hard times, religious literacy and stuff like that. We have taken the first step in that direction by starting to fill in that demographic. We're getting a whole lot. When I go, it's so different when I go speak to a free thought group now compared to 7 or 8 years ago even, which isn't that long. Now I go and it's so much more multi-generational and so much more multicultural and so on. We are filling in the donut hole. And when we do that, the programs will necessarily be created to keep the people. There's been this catch-22 up to this point. You know, you can't get the people there until you have the programs and so on. But all I can tell you is that it is in fact happening. Local groups are starting to do it. You have to make it a priority. And the number one most important thing for local groups to be doing now, I'm convinced, is childcare. It's that practical. Get a childcare thing going for your meetings or for your other events, and all of a sudden, it's actually possible for parents to come.
Raising my son mostly right now, my daughter's a little young right now, but I don't want to take away the growth of them to let them come up to their own decisions, but at the same time, I don't want to remain quiet about my views.
Right.
But they're only getting my views. They're not receiving the views from, like, grandma and stuff too much because they're not as open with religion, I guess. It's not a big deal of our family.
Yeah.
But how do I do that? How do I share that, like, I don't believe in Jesus with my son without trying to indoctrinate him to also not believe in Jesus? I want him to come to his own decision.
Right. Well, the very best thing you can do is every time you make a statement, every time you make a statement, you say, now, this is my opinion, and I've really thought hard about it, and I really think it's true. But you make up your own mind, and I will love you no less if you come to a different conclusion. I think it's really important for you to think on your own. I want you to talk to other people who believe differently, and you can change your mind as often as you want. If you follow it up with that, you will know that you've succeeded when your children start rolling their eyes when you start saying it.
Yeah.
Because mine eventually did. You know, I'd say, you know, now that's my opinion. You go, I know, you want us to make up our own minds, and then it's good. But one of the best things you can possibly do, my wife was Baptist when we got married and was for really the first 13, 14 years of our marriage. Now she considers herself a secular humanist. But I actually feel like we lost some advantage when she became a secular humanist. We actually had to work a little harder to make sure they were getting multiple perspectives for exactly that reason.
Do I need to worry about teaching them the other side or just...
You need to give them the opportunity to hear the other side, but I actually don't think it's entirely fair for their knowledge of Christianity to come through their atheist father.
Yeah.
I think really, I agree. To be honest about the process, get them in the hands of someone you trust who has a different perspective. Now, my mother-in-law, to my amazement and gratitude, I trust entirely. She's just been fantastic with this. If you have a relative, some relative who is religious and open, make that the person who can, you know, let them know what it is that you are doing. And they are frequently grateful to be included.
Like, we go to Easter egg hunt at my mom's church.
Yeah.
And I don't want my kids sitting through the Jesus story.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
To me, it's I have troubles with that.
Right. And or you can have them sit through the Jesus story and talk about it afterwards. It's either way is fine. I think the Jesus story I worry about less than the hell stuff. If kids... Keep the hell away from my kids, and I mean that. But the purpose of hell is to stop people from thinking. It's the last, you know. So it's the one religious idea I don't play fair with. The rest of it, I really, you know, I am okay with them listening to it. If kids hear two strong perspectives, two, yours and the other one, all of a sudden they get the message that there are hundreds. You know, that's when they start to realize that there's a choice. So I would go ahead and allow that and then just let them, if you prepare that critical thinking foundation in advance and then let them know that you're interested to talk about it just because you think it's interesting, not that you're going to, you know, pick it apart or anything like that, all sorts of stuff becomes possible. Yeah, sure.
All right. right, let's have another round of applause for Dale McGowan.